session.
Hello and welcome to everyone to what we've loosely dubbed the Great Debate, in which we're fortunate enough to have the two thought leaders to my right here in the educational and technology field, and who are going to be tackling some of the questions over the next hour that we've put together. Some of them were contributed by people in the audience. For those who did contribute questions, I think there's three in there that we've ended up selecting for inclusion in this, and I'll make sure that I embarrass the people who submitted the questions when the time comes. Our first panellist over on the right has already had his introduction this morning during the keynote. And so, firstly, could we please welcome Dr. Curtis Bolt from Indiana University. And our second panellist needs little in the way of introduction to those in the Moodle community. But for those who are new to Moodle, then I'd like to introduce the founder of Moodle and Managing Director of Moodle Headquarters, Martin Dugianis. And finally, before we kick off, I will be monitoring the Twitter feed, the MOOTAU10 Twitter feed here. I'm not accepting any new questions, but if people have any sort of comments on what the two panellists are discussing, then I'll do my best to keep an eye on the sort of problem or anything that you send through. So I'll do my best. Right. Now I think I'll start this one off with Director Kurt and then give Mark a chance. The first question, what do you see as the biggest challenge facing e-learning in the next few years and why?
We get at issues of challenges, we get at issues of e-learning, and it's like it's a thing. He's asking what the biggest challenge of e-learning is, this nebulous thing of e-learning. Is there a challenge in front of this thing, e-learning? In fact, there may be if we take a different perspective on this thing called e-learning. Some may say that, you know, it's the focus on the technologies, this thing, but in fact, it's the focus on human potential that I need. That I think is where we need to place the emphasis today. In the past, it was the four big ones: accreditation, plagiarism, quality, and copyright. Right? And even before that, it was training and accuracy of content and cost and time. Those were the big ones facing e-learning all the time. In fact, what I think it is, it's really a focus on human potential and access, going back to access to learning, which gets us into personalized learning environments. So I think the biggest challenge any of us in the e-learning field face is getting people to shift above these low-level concerns of plagiarism, access, quality, and accreditation, which are simple little things we've been dealing with for a millennia. We need to move to higher things like getting people to learn when they want to learn, how they want to learn, with whom they want to learn, and develop and grow to the highest levels that they can be. Sure, we'll have these accreditation issues. Certainly we'll have these quality and planning kinds of issues, but it's always been about human potential and growth. And we haven't been focusing on that in the e-learning field much at all. We've shifted away, at least in America, from humanistic concerns with the moral majority. All humanistic chapters and ed psych books got wiped out in 1990. I think it's time to go back to them. And I think e-learning can play a role in that, looking at human potential. So I think that's the biggest challenge, and PLEs is part of that challenge. I think adult education is part of that challenge. We've got 5 million people in Texas with part of a college degree that, or a university degree that never finished, 500,000 in my state alone. So I think potential of learning, especially with adults, but with kids as well, and personalizing that learning environment. Maybe it's not the thing, Moodle. So here's our debate.
Well, this is a very awkward format, debate. I love Kurt, I respect him totally. We got a question later about how we met, but I agree with what you said. I think there needs to be, we need to think about balance. There's a lot of, in this field, there's a lot of, this is the old way, it is bad. Let's go to this new way, it's good. And there's a lot of that, whereas I think the things that everyone used to do for years and years and years. We're working quite well. I mean, we're all educated, we're all sitting here. There is a lot of balance between what we pick and choose from new ways of doing things and how we implement or re-implement or replace older ways of doing things. And there's no one answer. Every school, every teacher, every institution, every country is going to have a different balance of these things as appropriate. For example, the PLE movement and the informal learning is obviously very important. I haven't sat a course myself for a long time. I just learn everything as I need to learn it, like we all do now using the tools we have. And we know it works because we're doing it. But when I'm hiring developers, there is a definite difference between developers who've taught themselves how to write code and developers who've done a computer science degree at a university. There is obviously something very important about the structured formal learning process that is very hard to replace. And so I think we as educational community need to sort out what that balance is and use everything available to us to get the best result. So I'm not sure there's a debate.
No, as I said, it's a loosely common debate, so it doesn't need to be that way at all. And we'll actually come back to that in one of the later questions about that sort of mixture between formal and informal learning. Next question, though, we've actually got a first of our delegate questions. And this one is from Rick Canale from La Trobe University. Where's Rick? Guess away, Rick. Rick's hiding over there. With the growing uptake of cloud-sourced social networking within education, what will the role of the LMS become? Is LMS development going to provide educators with a means to engage with learning by design, or will the LMS become an obstacle, or potentially even more of an obstacle? And based on that, should we be focusing on the LMS, or the cloud, or both?
We should probably swap, shouldn't we? I developed a little LMS. But if you look in Moodle 2, a lot about what we're doing is about opening up that LMS to connect with the rest of the internet. Back when I started Moodle, there wasn't much in the way of easy to access cloud services, as you just call them now. What we were really doing was building that kind of environment in miniature inside a course, and that's why Moodle has all these various tools that you pick and choose from and plug together to create your own managed learning space. Of course, now there is a world of things available out there, and everyone's using them, and they should be connected with the course space. So I think that's my answer, is that LMSs are, or ours is anyway, evolving to embrace that stuff and to use that stuff. However, there is still a role for the LMS and for the course management system, in that you need a protected area, a place to learn that is not out on the web. We may differ on this, Kurt, I don't know. But a lot of particularly younger students, teachers and parents and educators that I've talked to feel unsure about putting their 6-year-olds and 10-year-olds out on the wider web necessarily. So there is a role for safe spaces to learn and experiment with communicating and using the same sorts of tools, but in a more closed environment. I think that will continue. That said, with Moodle, you can actually throw the whole thing wide open. The balance of how open it is totally left up to the people implementing that site. You can actually fiddle with roles and make Moodle so that as soon as you arrive at the website, you're an administrator, if you want. You can actually throw it open to that degree. So, but I don't see many people doing that, and they won't be doing that for some time.
Okay. Yes, what's interesting here is the question within the question, right? And he's asking about socially constructed learning by design, and then he wants us to choose between an LMS and the cloud. He's asking for this technology solution or that technology solution, in effect leaving learning up in the hands of technologists. right? So where do we go? What do we do? Is it about the LMS or the cloud? Should we be asking, is it either one, or is it both, or is it neither? It's a difficult question, actually. And it's one which is pretty important right now for us to ask. I'm sure all of us are wrestling with this issue, but at the same time, we need to be asking it, thinking about nature and nurture, technology being nature and nurture being pedagogy, and then the customs, culture, and the people we're working with. It's all three things. It's not just the technologies of the cloud or this, but really it is about the LMS within the cloud. If we're not thinking about the LMS within the cloud, then we're kind of ignoring really any kind of monitoring of the learning that's taking place, any kind of residual record keeping that's taking place within someone as we continue to learn throughout our lifetimes. We will need some kind of a long-term record, stepping stone, if you will, reflection points with our online learning gurus that we'll get from having Moodle mark where we've been and where we haven't been and where we might go. So I actually do think the LMS plays a significant role, and as it evolves within the Web 2.0 to add portfolios and wikis and all sorts of things, it will overlap and it will get people who are in the cloud not thinking about the learning to, in fact, think about the learning that's taking place. So I do think the LMS does that for us. It does push us backwards into behavioral theory and management of learning, but it also pushes us ahead and thinking about the personalization of that learning, and therein lies the tension. Now, the tension really is not in the cloud, the tension's in the LMS and where that's headed, I think. And I think Moodle, with its social constructivistic kind of a framework, at least gets us to start a dialogue about the possibilities for pushing ahead to the potential for constructing, socially constructing, and interacting about knowledge. We will see a convergence, I think, between the cloud and the LMS. We will see ubiquity. It will be just something that we are within, I think. The LMS will be in the cloud, and the LMS will help us focus on education. So I hope, on the other hand, we have many of us focus on the pedagogy that's used within the LMSs to push the learning side even further and further and further.
Okay. Just a thought that came up through that is in many parts of the world, they're still approaching online learning as a new thing. It's very new. You don't go straight from having a bricks and mortar school to throwing all your students into YouTube and Flickr and Facebook. But it does make sense to kind of have a bricks and, you know, a little bricked area on the internet, an LMS system with walls, if you like. That's an easier jump to make as a first step. Even in Germany, if you think of it, geez, you know, a modern industrial nation, they're still having arguments about should there be computers and classrooms in some parts of the country.
So the point is, I think part of what Mark's saying is that some people aren't even in this debate yet. They're just getting their feet wet and feeling actually like they're making some progress when they're adopting an LMS to some degree, whether it's with primary, secondary, high school, college, or corporate, or military. So this debate might not be a global debate right now, but it is still an important one that we need to wrestle with.
And just a slight follow-up on that attempt to sort of open up the LMS and take into account some of the sort of more cloud or open technology stuff, how much that has driven Moodle 2's development? Has that been something that's been in the back of your mind as far as...
For sure. I'm very driven by what people ask for and what I want to do. And I want to bring media in and out of Moodle. I want things that I do elsewhere to come into Moodle, and I want things I do in Moodle to go elsewhere. There's a lot of what's in Moodle 2 is about. And I'll talk about that tomorrow for a keynote. But,
we might still have a keynote tomorrow. I'll turn this one over your way. I believe you two first met in June 2003. Firstly, could you just give us a quick overview of how it was that you actually met? And secondly, I'd like to hear what have been the biggest changes in, I'll say, learning or / online learning?
Mm. I was standing like right over here with a beer in this hand.
That was
and, And Ron Oliver was standing here, and he says, have you seen the Moodle Man? I mean, Julian claims to be the Moodle Man, but back in 2003, it was this guy over here. He said, have you seen the Moodle Man? What do you mean, the Moodle Man? Well, that guy over in the other end of the social, you know? So I moseyed over to talk to Martin on the other end of the social, and still had the beard in my hand. He said, let's go over to Duke's Waikiki. This is a conference called Ed Media in 2003, and he says, I'll put a beer in your other hand. So we had a nice chat about where things were going in the LMS field at the time. And we talked about partnering at some different things at the time. In fact, we haven't, but we've been corresponding back and forth. He actually helped me with my World is Open book in a number of places. And what's happened since 2003 is really phenomenal in many ways. We track what's gone on in the past 7 years. And many of them I mentioned in the talk this morning, and Martin will mention them tomorrow. And others of you are mentioning them as well. But for one, e-learning has become sort of ubiquitous. It's something we take for granted. It's part of what we do. And in 2003, it wasn't quite there. I think we're still, you know, in that first decade of serious attempts at e-learning per se. Although yesterday I pointed out this goes back to the 1980s and 90s and even 70s. Second is this OCW movement, OER movement, you know, open courseware, open ed resources. And that to me is a significant undertaking, that providing a free educational contents to go along with free and open source software technology. So we got them what's happened is we've got the free and open source software related to technology. We also have a community. The gift culture has extended from the technology field and the hackers to those people developing contents. And that's a significant undertaking right there. What is this gift culture? Why do I, you know, I get this question all the time. Why am I developing stuff free in the world? And there are many reasons to do that, which I kind of alluded to with Terry Anderson's book this morning and others that I mentioned. The other is the growth at the primary, secondary, middle school levels, I think, over the past 2 years in particular, and community college of Voc Ed. We started in the late 90s at the corporate level and at the tertiary or higher education level. That's where the action was happening in 1995 to 2001. I think since 2005-ish, it's been community college in the U.S. and middle school, high school, and around the world. So that's another area. And along with that, the Web 2.0 has sprung up to offer us possibilities to not just put up content on the web as shovelware, as his advisor Ron Oliver would call it, but to actually let people participate. And really, his Martin's philosophy for teaching and learning has really come to fruition with the Web 2.0 possibilities. And I'd like to hear more about that. Maybe tomorrow Martin will allude to where he thinks things are going now that the technology has caught up with his vision, or at least starting to catch up with his vision. I also think we've seen a bit of an explosion at the higher, at tertiary level, of synchronous learning. In the 1990s, none of us could afford synchronous, the corporates could. But most of us in the higher ed space and K-12 space couldn't afford it, and today we can. So that's another significant change. And finally, this conference. It wasn't here in 2003, at least not to this degree. It was Martin and I chatting in Hawaii at Duke's Waikiki. That was probably it. Now, he had probably had some Moodle people meeting in his basement or garage sipping beer somewhere. But, you know, to look at around you and the people in the room and the number of countries you're coming from, you know, this is pretty amazing. So right there, we know we have a community that's interested in not just the technology being open source, but the contents being open source, and how to provide an education for the people of this planet in efficient, effective, enhancing, engaging, all these e-ways, e-learning kinds of opportunities. So there's a lot that's gone on in the last 7 years that we should be excited about, and we often yawn about it.
Yeah, I first came across you in some of your papers. I was at Curtin University, I was the webmaster at the university, and we installed version 1 of WebCT when it was free, and we're using it. And as it got bigger and bigger, and they sold it, and you could no longer ring up the developers anymore. There was suddenly support lines and channels and so on. And so it became very hard to work with the software. Science background, and that's when I was thinking I could start developing Moodle. And I went and did this a master's with Peter Taylor as my supervisor, and he has a very good focus on what's really important, I think, in communication and education. And it's terrific to work with. And one of the papers I discovered was this one, which is an Ed Media paper. searching for learner-centered, constructivist, and social cultural components of collaborative educational learning tools. DJ Cutton, remember that one? 98?
Yeah.
And I really was enjoying your papers there, and they were really useful to me at that point. And I, so that's actually was seeking you out. And you aren't supposed to choose the reviewers to be a PhD. Normally the supervisor does that, but I chose this man based on your papers. So I was actually hunting you down at DBE 2003. And Ron Oliver was the other guy.
It's like the pretty woman at the other end of blinking at me. He was merely wanted to meet up, but he was hiding on the other end of the conference. But you know, a funny little thing is Peter Taylor's work, his advisor's work, was work I was reading in 1989, 90, 91, 92. I was developing the social constructivism and active learning environment scale, the scale, S-C-A-L-E. And his advisor had created the CLESS, the constructivist learning environment scale. So it's kind of interesting how things evolve. You know, people who are in different spaces influence one another. You go around and you influence each other back and forth. So.
Well, it's not such a big community, actually. The CLESS scale is in Moodle, actually, with a survey tool. The survey module in Moodle was the very first module I ever wrote. It was a standalone system, and I wrote Moodle to kind of support that survey tool and then added more and more as well. But I wanted to talk to you then. And we did have a good chat and a good beer at Duke's. At that time, Moodle had only been released, it'd only been out really for 6 months or something like that. And the first day it was available, I had someone from British Columbia, the Moodler number two, a guy called Jacob Romain, who was about 70 years old and running a girls' college. And first day he downloaded it and was using it, was giving me feedback. And the numbers have just gone exponential since then. And already 6 months later, their media, I was able to show lots of statistics and fairly exciting stuff about how this project was taking off. But the actual paper I was presenting was about the postgrad work I was doing and studying some particular courses at Curtin University in depth. So I was analysing forum posts and interactions, and it was that process that was the early development of Moodle. I was studying these interactions very, very closely, and because Moodle at that point was a lot smaller, I could write new code. I could extend Moodle like the next day. So there'd be something in the forum, some interaction going on, and like they need to, rating each other would be good at this point. Next day, I had all night, I had ratings. Just was doing feature after feature like that in response to these courses.
Is it fair to say that it started out as being necessity being the mother of invention in terms of you kicking off that initial work? Thank you for commenting that one.
Yes, for sure. I mean, the term used in the open source community is scratching an itch. You have an itch and you scratch it. That's very much a whole series of itches. It was very itchy. My very early prototypes, the very first idea I remember it was like the turning point. I said I should really write something. Was when I realised if you get a whole lot of people doing things in parallel like this, and then you take a cross section across that way, you have a very interesting result as a teacher. That's not very clear; it's too generic. But say, for example, you get all the students doing a whole lot of activities this way. If you look at the activities that way, comparing one assignment to one question or one post, then you have a very useful tool to think about what the whole class is doing at that point in time. And it's manifested in all kinds of ways in Moodle. But obviously since then, I thought at that time that I was going to finish my PhD, become an academic, sitting in a university, probably not actually university very much by the sound of it, but I thought Moodle would be this hobby thing I did in the evenings. And I rapidly found that I had to support myself. So I started helping people who needed help, and they started paying me a little bit, and so the business side model started to get going, and at some point I realised, do I want to be CEO of a company, or do I want to write software? And I decided to stick with the software, and so that's why we have Moodle Partners and all that. Seems like a much longer time than what's been.
Quick little three little things there is one, he read the article that came out of my electronic library is both at the publisher, let us put it on the web for free. It's an early example of open access articles. I had convinced them to put a chapter on the web for free in 98. At the same time, I was working with Linda Harrison. I went off to Simon Fraser and wrote a paper on pedagogical activities on the smart web. The smart web was a class I was working on. I linked it to social constructivistic principles, all the activities in the class. I never published that one. The following year, at the same Med Media Conference, 1999, which is 4 years before we met, Bailey Collis ran a workshop, a full day like we had yesterday here, a full day workshop on the future of LMSs. And Vanessa Bennett and I, who's now at Florida State, we had proposed to create a system, a learning management system that would enable you to do creativity, critical thinking, collaborative learning. You'd have also, you have templates that would pop up. You want to debate like we're maybe doing now, a rebuttal, a critique, a brainstorming, reverse brainstorming session. We'd have all the kind of a menu-driven activity list of things that that your instructor could select from. And we saw a dearth of pedagogical activities in Blackboard and WebCT and Virtual Classroom and all the other tools, the e-classroom, all these other ones. So we had proposed this kind of a system back in 99, and I met people from Blackboard at a conference, and I suggested that they build something like that to them, and they just said, put it in our building blocks. And in fact, what Blackboard was saying is, we're not going to build anything that's pedagogically relevant. We're going to let you build it and spend your money on it. We'll take advantage of it. And I found that to be a poor excuse for somebody in the education space at the time. So I was very happy a few years later to meet someone like Martin, who was pushing ahead in the space of trying to develop pedagogical tools. So there's a lot of this evolution of ideas and back and forth, and I think people just kind of meet up, and here you all are. And you'll get to hear from them tomorrow.
Okay. I think we'll stay with you to start this one. This is another question from a delegate. Oren Kelly from Macau. Where's Oren today? I see it. Yeah, I'll get back there. Oren's question, I've often said that any teacher who thinks they can be replaced by a piece of technology probably should be. But I'm sure that any teacher who's not using technology to support their teaching will be replaced by those who are. So if teachers still have a role, what do we think it should or will be?
You know, I was presenting on this topic back in 2000-2001 on the multiple roles of the instructor, and we're still not there yet in terms of the vision that I was trying to lay out. You know, I talked about it today, in fact, being a counselor or a concierge or a facilitator. But, you know, beyond that, I think our jobs, those of us that are in the teaching instruction side of the fence anyhow, we're going to get split up into many different occupations at some point. This is bound to happen. Most of us are overwhelmed with so many tasks that we're being called upon to do today that we didn't have 20 years ago. I mean, I think things have changed, but we haven't been, nothing's been taken away from us. Things have been added to our menu of what we do. But I think some of us will be tutors, and some of us will be facilitators. Some of us will be the ones designing the courses, and some of us will be the assessors, and some will be the advisors. Some will help students figure out their career counseling. You know, they'll be touching base with you for their future, and where you'll be giving them advice on where they're going to go. But I don't see us going that direction in the next few years yet. I think we're probably still at least a decade away from that. I think we're going to be continuing to be overwhelmed with more job duties placed upon us, but I think there are thoughtful ways to teach and instruct and learn in online environments that we're still starting to understand those efficiencies. So that's why we're not going to see any slackening initially, because we're still in this beginning stage of things. But eventually things will ferret out with all the competition, with all the global collaborations, with the for-profits, the non-profits, the University of the People, the peer-to-peer university, all these things are popping up, which is going to create new opportunities. And some of us will create our own opportunities. Some of us will create our own jobs, our own futures, if you will. And there'll be a lot of opportunities for that. So I saw seven different occupations in the future, and I touched upon some of those just right there. And Howard Gardner, the multiple intelligence expert, mentioned some of these as well. If you read some of his writings about the future of teachers and what jobs that they might have, depending on match his notion of multiple intelligence, so they'll have multiple teaching roles. If you will, I think teaching has become more important than ever before, more complex than ever before, more fun than ever before. I teach online. It's one of the most creative things you can do. It's one of the most frustrating and difficult things one can do. I teach video conferencing because the sun never sets on an online class, and video conferencing you can be more animated. So, you know, then you can be, but with synchronous you can be animated. So I think the technologies will create some new opportunities, but so will the formats of the higher education organizations and the schools and so forth.
Yes, I agree with what you're saying. Maybe I'll add a couple of things. One is, I'm sure most of us have had experience with one particular teacher who really took the time to listen to you, to understand you, to see where you're at, and help you with a problem. And maybe they were a mentor for a significant period of time, where any problem you had in that field, you could just go and ask them, and they would just clear it up, and you could move on. That when you make a human connection with a teacher, when a teacher makes that connection with a student, that's so important and so, that's why the whole question of will teachers be done away with doesn't make any sense to me, because that can't be replaced by nearly any amount of stuff online. So I still don't think that's important. So I still think that teachers need to be there in an online environment and an offline environment. What teachers need to do, should do, is embrace the power of the internet, which is not inherently a one-to-one medium and is a many-to-many medium. And to take that position of a concierge is a new one, just to add to the list of facilitators and so on, but to take that risk to create and to think about how can I create an environment where the students are teaching each other in a very effective way, but that I can still be there to kind of drive things, to spot trends, to spot the outliers, the student being left behind, or perhaps see that this part of the course is no longer necessary, or I can just skip this bit, spend more time on something else, to add new topics, to bring in media, to bring in experiences, stories. Those are all things that teachers can do that you do not find in your average online forum. If you look at the comments section under any YouTube video, there's a learning environment going on there. It's very thin visually. There are countless numbers of forums that people say it's about a particular brand of car and working on those engines or something, some enthusiast group, right? So they'll throw up a forum and all the enthusiasts will hang out there and they'll be learning from each other a lot. They'll learn an awful lot. And as adult learners, a lot of us are probably involved in special interest groups like that and Facebook and so on. But if you have a facilitator in there and it's better, undoubtedly, from all the experiences I've seen. So I still think teachers have a very important role. They just have different roles.
Let me add to that. Back in 1990, I was at a conference in Chicago at the American Education Research Association, where I met Peter Taylor talking about the class. Another gentleman on our panel is from Tasmania, who was talking about metaphors of teaching, and teacher as prison warden, teacher as orchestra conductor, teacher, teaching and learning as a garden and all this stuff. And so metaphors of thinking about metaphors of teaching and learning, really that's where we need to start, touching base with the people we're training to teach in online environments. What is the metaphor you use of yourself as a teacher within when you use Moodle or whatever systems you're using? And so this notion of a concierge is one of probably 40 that I have my teachers, instructors think about in terms of themselves teaching within online environments. And go back to your hotel rooms tonight, watch the concierge and what he or she is doing. And in fact, I blog posted on teacher as concierge. It's actually in my book a bit. I think that is one way to think about it, or even a fitness instructor or whatever, someone who creates a map or a guide, because there are all these resources. With this plethora of resources in front of us, we need people who can make sense of them a bit and lay out journeys and paths within it so that we in fact can learn. And when we get at some of these questions about teacher is going to be replaced, keep in mind that we're doing more learning than we ever did before. With all the informal learning things happening, the bucket of learning is exploding. We're going to continue to have this bucket
So what's been happening in the past might not necessarily go away. We're going to emphasize some of these new opportunities to learn that don't involve teachers. That doesn't mean that the other things that have happened along the way that did involve teachers are going by the wayside, except when you can maybe replicate them through a video or whatever. But I think that sense of social caring, that connectedness, that belongingness to a community of learners is going to be even more important as we have so many resources that can, in fact, impact on our learning. So maybe it's we've given a long-winded answer to this question to say neither of us know.
Well, to throw possibly another one, it's a bit of a curve. I don't know, I've got to shuffle this around a little bit based on a couple of things that I've been watching on the toy screen. You've been talking about changes to roles and changes to individuals and what those individuals are doing, whether as teacher or learner. The question I'd like next to ask is, what's the impact going to be on the acceptance of informal learning as a valid educational method on what is a very traditional academic structure, such as schools, universities, so more around the processes and how they are going to need to shift to accommodate the liberalised informal learning?
Well, it's always been there, hasn't it?
It has always been.
Learning. I mean, you learn from your friends after school, you learn from libraries, watching the TV and, reading books, fiction or non-fiction, always learning informally anyway. So I don't see a really big difference, really, except that information's a little more accessible now. And I love the way, probably in the last 5 years, I haven't thought of a question that I haven't been able to answer in about 2 minutes, which is really the big change, I think. I'm using Google or something, obviously. I'm not sure it probably is significant that, I guess facts are not so important, but process is more important, teaching process. And going back to my experiences with developers, which is my main experience for the last few years, is that you really can see in skill, when you're looking at someone in terms of skills, the processes are what's most important, not information. And that sort of does need to be taught somehow.
On Friday I was at Victoria Hotel on an informal learning seminar, all day congress. Some of you, any of you there on Friday? I believe you said you might be coming here. And then this question came up from an assessment person, right? And she wanted to know how we're going to assess informal learning outcomes. I mean, isn't it? We don't always assess everything that takes place. There are some things you do for the sake of doing it and learning personal satisfaction from it. But what happens when we have more growing acceptance? So the question is growing acceptance of informal learning. I think we have a shift in the culture. I think we have more acceptance of us as learning beings. I think this is the learning century. By 2060 and 2070, we'll call this the learning century. I don't think there's any doubt about that, given what we've seen happen just in the last 10 years alone. And we're all going to have perhaps a role in how this whole century maps out. But we'll see a blurring undoubtedly between formal and informal types of learning. We'll see us engaged in so many different learning pursuits all the time. With all the mobile presentations here in the last couple of hours, makes that a definite presentation from Brazil or from here in Australia. So the learning possibilities explode when you go to informal as an add-on or as part of who you are as a human being. But I think I have a human development doctorate, actually, in learning doctorate. I think we will see maybe start thinking about new stages of human development, because keep in mind, Piaget only went to age 14, 15, 16 with formal learning. And we never got studied things beyond age 16. Now think about all of us living to 80, 90, 100 years old and learning constantly. There's going to be something new shaken out of all that, I think, whether it's systematic ways of understanding the world or something else. So, I think one is new stages of human development will evolve from more emphasis on informal kinds of learning. And I think education will be the constant within our lives, and cultures, in fact, will change. And models of learning, our instructional design models, may fall apart. I mean, they don't really hold water all that well in online environments already. Most of the instructional design models are pretty basic, blah, blah, boring to heck. Out of most people out there, I hate to say it because I have an office next to Charlie Regaluth, who's one of the most famous instructional designer
His two big, thick green books about instructional design. But you know, if you want to shape and create learning for someone and put them in lockstep events, boy, you're really doing an injustice given all the possibilities for active and engaging learning that we have today. Now, those were the possibilities of yesterday, and we haven't caught up with it in our instructional design models. We have to take a learning environment point of view. When we change to a learning environment point of view, that informal learning becomes a big part of what it is that we do, in fact, as learners.
A tweet just came through from Jeff Young, Jeff is at Newark from Woodrow Tech, saying that assessments in particular are informal learning, great for the student, awful for the teacher. Thoughts?
You mean assessment of assessment, not informal? Don't ask me. I like to take advice on these things from people who are doing it. So with a different format here, I'd be asking everyone out here who's probably tackled that more. Probably could be some experience.
So here he is. He's thinking about traditional forms of learning within a non-traditional event. And I mean, this non-traditional event is informal learning, assuming that the teacher is the one who's assessing and not necessarily the person that informal learning might be impacting. You might be helping someone in a corporate setting with some kind of product. Why is the teacher the only one who's assessing that item, whatever was in fact learned in that situation? So there's self-assessment, there's peer assessment, there's computer-based assessment, there's expert assessment, and there's teacher assessment, and probably 20 other kinds of assessment. So we have to break out of these modes. It's not just about teacher, student, online. Practitioners, people in the real world can give feedback to your students. We have to get our courses on the web to involve experts in the real world, particularly practitioners. That's where you're really going to get some powerful learning taking place. We analyzed 80 courses in the World Lecture Hall back in 1999 or 2000. One course used practitioners. One course had experts from the outside impacting on it. And look at the possibilities. Again, we've been constrained by traditional models, and we don't have to be anymore. So, but the same, and here's the other part of that question. He's assuming that it's a nightmare assessing informal learning. I'll bet you if I asked you, would you rather be grading a multiple choice test or some optional assignment that a student chose to pick that's something novel and different, I'll bet you 9 out of 10 of us would prefer to grade and find more exciting to grade that informal assignment than grading a formal one. So I think the premise there is wrong. I think and I do them all the time. We're doing YouTube videos and video blogging. Those are exciting things. It's hard, but it's not something that I dread grading.
Actually, I do have some other answers. Some technological answers, actually. I guess the portfolio is where that fits in. In general, there seems to be an approach towards, or push towards portfolios as a way to be more inclusive and include all kinds of evidence of learning. The key being that you put it in the hands of the student to do the work to collect that portfolio and present it in a form that is easier to grade. So if you make it their responsibility to gather perhaps assessments from outside experts or the assessments from internal staff in the course, but also evidences of their writing or an award they got from the UN or something, anything all becomes part of that shouldn't be too hard to assess. It should be quite interesting to assess.
Yeah, I'm using a lot of the writing assessments, the dimensional scoring things that came out of the 1980s now in my classes today. I think we have to look 20 years back to think about today. There's a lot of interesting things that was going on 20 years ago in the writing across the curriculum movements, process writing, all this stuff. And there was a whole slew of new assessment tools that were developed that I call it difficult to use that get us away from holistic scoring to more looking at the skills you want to enhance within your classes. Whether it is coherent thought or originality or whatever it is that you're choosing to use. We might need more training in new kinds of assessments, though, to help people out into this field of informal learning assessment. That's probably true. Yeah.
And next question sort of flows on from what you're just talking about picking up new skills and trying new things. It's another delicate question. This one is from Chris Delaney from St. Amos Parish in Secondary School. As a passionate Moodler, how do I encourage colleagues at my school to move forward with Moodle and more broadly with other e-learning tools, given the limited time, money and resources at
most or many educational institutions.
It shows them that it works. I mean, you've got to genuinely prove it works. You can't, it's not a trick. So you actually have to have some situation that can see that there's a benefit to using it. If there isn't, then you shouldn't be using Moodle. Seems pretty simple to me. But that's it, really.
Yeah, my first two words were show and tell. You know, I mean, exactly what Martin's saying. But I think there are two questions here, you see. Let's go to the first one. I mean, show and tell, best practices, sharing data, testimonials. You know, start with what's working, you know, and create a sharing kind of community. So those are things that can be done. But the backup question to all this is, why don't we deal with resistant, reluctant, and reticent, the big R's out there, instructors to all this? And I think in the past year, we've seen a reduction in resistance. We've moved from the stage, as I mentioned yesterday, we go from awareness of what's possible to resistance, to understanding, to use, to advocacy, and to sharing. We've now moved from that resistance stage, stage two, to understanding and use stages. At the same time, some faculty, some teachers, some administrators, some students are still at that resistance stage. So how do we deal with that? And I think it's a multi-pronged approach. There's no one particular strategy that works well. In fact, in my R2D2 book, the one chapter they deleted was how to deal with resistant faculty. My publisher deleted it. It's the most popular chapter in the book. If anybody wants to send me an email, I'm happy to send it to you. It never got published. But you know, some people might deal in hardcore kinds of incentives, like iPads, iPods. We're giving away laptop computers to all of faculty. You'll get 16 hours of training. You give 8 hours of training, you get a laptop. We also start or end department meetings talking about how you use technology in your classrooms. We also showcase things in our student union in the summertime for a couple of days. All the interesting online learning projects happening across our campus is showcased. We have a website of testimonials and best practices. We have quick hitter books. We have tutorial support. I mean, it's just a conglomeration of things that change the lingo, change the culture. The statistics faculty that looked at me cross-eyed in 1992 when I was teaching with technology are now bringing laptops into their classes, doing cute, cool animations, all sorts of things, but they're supportive of it. They're being trained for it. And they're like excited about it. And this is 18 years later. It's not going to happen overnight, but you can change the culture throughout. Create a plan, create a vision. I talked about Central Florida this morning. Go to the University of Central Florida site. They have a plan. They have a framework for training. And if you want to change to Moodle and get people excited about Moodle, you know, have a ground-up approach and create a plan to do so, along with all things show and tell. You know, and that's a great way to start.
Sure.
So I've got two more things. One is a lot of the excitement, if there is that word, about Moodle is actually excitement about the internet. Now, a lot of people, if you're trying to get people into Moodle, often you're just trying to get them into the internet and using the internet for online learning. The best way to do that I've found is to get them into a position of a student in an authentic activity. So Moodle.org was constructed deliberately like that to use Moodle. My classroom is the Using Moodle course, basically, on Moodle.org. And it's a way for people to get in a community of Moodle users as participants, as students, if you like, and to experience it from that point of view. And once you do that, then you start thinking of the potential of what would happen in your own life and your own teaching, you know, how you could be managing that and using such an environment with some empathy for what students are feeling. I'm sure a lot of you have been in some forum or some online discussion where the conversation took off, where it catches fire. And that's what you want to try and make happen, because once you've experienced that situation where you're really engaged, you know, maybe you set up a course to discuss faculty issues, you know, a couple of old chestnuts in there, some old display wars and discussions, and get them going and get people riled up. And they'll be logging in every morning, you know, getting their oar in. But once they get a bit excited about it, they realise, oh, this is cool. We can't have this kind of discussion in the staff room. Actually, I've got a story about that where I tried to do that for my kids' school. There was an issue. Can I tell the story here? Okay, I'll try and keep it short. But basically, there was an issue where the founder of the school got sacked by a committee of parents, and nobody knew what was going on at all. And there was all these discussions in twos and threes in the corners of the schoolyard. And after a while, I said, bugger this, I'm going to set up a forum. And I set up a Moodle site, and I gave out accounts to everyone who I could find, and I said, pass this on, pass it on. Within a day or two, we had 90 parents in there and staff working out the issues. And 2 weeks later, much emotional drama went on, but we had an AGM and we managed to sort the whole mess out. And it was terrific. It was a really good example of online learning, everyone learning about this topic together and resolving it together. However, they will now not touch Moodle with a barge pole because they always associate it with the bad times, which is a bit disheartening. But anyway, now you could do that, do something like that. The second thing is, that was the first thing about getting them to experience it. The second one is, I'll talk about more tomorrow, we have this community hub idea, which is about sharing examples of best practice. And I think if any teacher sees another teacher's course in the same fields, at the same level, in the same language, it's much easier to see the possibilities of it.
Was that one of the drivers behind the community hubs venture and moving to?
It's the driver that's behind community hubs. Yeah, it's about getting teachers to learn about online learning.
In yesterday's master class, we got at a lot of these ways to make online learning engaging, and you can download those slides from yesterday at a couple different places. In fact, from the conference slide as well as from my slides, and so. A lot of things he's talking about, heated debates and discussions. Those of you who were with us yesterday, we were talking about that. And online learning is a place where that can happen very easily. So,
and I think we're almost out of time. I'll ask one more short question. 2010, and I'll say the 2010 financial year since 2010 half off. Is this going to be the year of the e-book for education, in particular with the rise of the iPad?
And I know that the other question you're not asking us is the one about where technology is going and the emerging technology. I think we might be able to tackle both in the same question potentially, because both are difficult in some ways. But I think 2009 was the year of the e-book, not 2010. I think it happened last year, around July, August, or whatever. And yet I don't think it was, in fact, the year of the e-book. I don't think this is the year of the e-book. I think 2012 is going to be the year of the e-book. And then we're going to say 2013, and then we're going to say 2014 is the year of the e-book. You know, we've been saying it since in 2000. My students walked up to me and said, Dr. Bonk, your book's an e-book. I said, what do you mean my book's an e-book? They didn't tell me about this. I helped write this book, and I was using the book, and the dang publishers didn't even tell the instructors they were using the book or the people who were authors of the book. That's how bad the e-book market was in 2000, right? And we kept hearing about this is the year of the e-book, and then all of a sudden there'd be a big dive. E-books are crashing in 2001 in Germany, some conference there. I was like, a headline news. 2002, it's the year of the e-book again. And we've been hearing this for a decade. I think actually in July 2009, we finally hit that breaking point of acceptability. We hit the 5% of maybe books within bookstores, that being e-books and university bookstores, maybe not K-12 yet. But does that mean it's the year of the e-book? I'm not so sure. I think it's going to be the year of the e-book when we are all totally blown away by the interactive, engaging possibilities in front of us to learn, and we carry these around with us. When the majority of us in the room come to a Moodle conference with those in hand, and I see a number of you with iPads, it's getting close. So I think 2009 was an indicator. I think 2010 is an indicator. But what I hear coming down the pipeline in terms of books, and what I understand in terms of numbers of adults wanting to learn from these indicates that maybe 2012 might be the year of the e-book. I'm going to guess if I had to name a time down there, but these are convergent tools. These have a number of the openers built within them, and as we add more of those openers, we have more possibilities to in fact learn. These are the first of many tools. The iPad's the first of many such convergent devices. It's in the convergent devices, whether it's a pen, or a watch or something else. We're going to be excited about a pen or a watch in a couple of years here. The other technologies that I'm just going to mention that I think are interesting, I think we're going to have mobile transformer tools, you know, those old transformers, you can reshape them into something else. We're going to take our phones
and have bendable text and fold them out and all sorts of things to have expanded screens, if you will, to learn from full-length novels on our mobile smartphone devices. I think intelligent databases are going to become more important in the future and tapping into them. If you haven't seen Wolfram Alpha, where you do all these map, I mean, it's not foolproof, it's not 100% accurate, but it's pretty interesting, the database that it calls up to answer your calculus questions or answer weather-related questions or whatever it is you want to know about. Wolfram Alpha kind of has an answer. I think artificial intelligence is going to try to finally find a way into the e-learning space. And I'm one who in 1985 invested in Symbolics and other artificial intelligence companies and lost almost all of it because of ethical dilemmas those companies were getting into. And my mother, who gave me that money for graduate school, has been saving it for how long, 30 years for me, was not happy with me at the time. But I think, you know, people overhyped artificial intelligence in the early 1980s. And we overhyped e-learning in 2000, 2001. I hope we didn't overhype it too much, but I think we're finally at the point where the AI is going to help us index content and access content. All this video content, Bill Gates wants to create an artificial intelligence access to those shared online video content. So I think that those are some of the things I see coming down the road in this coming decade. They'll be interesting and engaging for us.
Okay. I'm sure just a 60 seconds. Sorry,
yeah.
We're out of time.
That's all right.
That's all right.
Look, I was, didn't have only 60 seconds worth of stuff to say. Yes to all that. I think what I'm seeing mostly is, in more of the near term, is a swing back to apps. We swung from the desktop with lots of apps to the web, and the web was like the app, and everything was going to be in the browser. And we seem to be swinging back towards apps again, because the interactivity you get on an app, I'm talking about things on these sorts of things, phones or iPads, is much higher. A pretty good example, look at the Twitter site, and then look at the Twitter app, and compare them. Usability is like an order of magnitude. And it's so convenient. Just click and you're there. There's no URLs, there's no navigation to get there, hardly at all. It's really your set of apps, one fingertip away. So I think that is probably the major trend. And we are working on a Moodle app as well, which is a reconceptualization of the interface for that particular environment, whether it be on an iPad or on a small phone size thing. So I think that's probably the major trend I'm seeing in the internet.
Okay, we are out of time. I'd like to ask everyone to join me. Thank you.
Have this chance to have this discussion or debate. And those who were with me yesterday know yesterday it was a Star Wars theme, this morning's Indiana Jones, and you can see right now it's a Men in Black theme. Okay, so if you want to bring us, we'll be happy to do this again sometime, I think. Right, Mark?
Thanks. Well, thank you all. And it could be a bit more too late, this one, but we've got the next couple of days to chat more, so thank you. Thank you.